So everybody, welcome to the February Citizens Climate Lobby call. You know, we've had a lot of scientists on the call talking to different issues regarding climate change. We've had a lot of economists on. We've had messaging experts. We've had military experts. We've had people talking to faith-based issues. We've never had a call dedicated to what is happening in the ocean, so we're very happy that on this call we could have Dr. Martin Trasgueras, who will start speaking in about 4 or 5 minutes, discussing what's happening with ocean, particularly as related to ocean acidification. So a couple things I want to let everybody know before that is the 2013 Citizens Climate Lobby International Conference is now officially open for registration. So if you're going to be joining Dr. James Hansen, Dr. Shiling Su with us in Washington, D.C. in June, there is limited space, so it would be a good idea to get yourself registered as soon as possible. For those of you who are guests on the call, the people who are on this call on a regular basis treat political will as something that is malleable, something that can be shaped, something that people do have something to do about, that the condition in Washington, D.C., to get things done, or Ottawa in Canada, is not static. And if you look at recently what's been happening with gun control and immigration, you couldn't predict that not very long ago. So we've been working very intently to generate political will, and there's a couple of avenues that we work very focused on. One is developing relationships with members of Congress and their staff, and then also getting published. And I think a lot of people know that we hit a significant milestone. Last November was the first time we had over 100 pieces published in 1 month by the group. So if you add a combination of letters to the editor, op-eds, editorials, articles, it was the first time that we got over 100 pieces published. And it established a whole new standard of us reaching out to people. Not only did it set a whole new standard, but because of the work of constantly reaching out to editorial boards and publishing high-quality letters and op-eds, we're starting to see a significant increase in the number of newspapers who are printing editorials saying the country really needs, both countries, the U.S. and Canada, need a carbon tax. Now, you could not predict that a year ago. And one of the things that's allowed us to do is this week we began a program where on a either monthly or every other monthly basis, we will be compiling important pieces that you generated, putting them in a one-page format, and then sending it to the key aides on the committees that work with this issue in Washington, D.C. So that would include Senate Finance, that would include Ways and Means in the House of Representatives. So there's 5 key committees that we know any bill that we would want to publish would have to go through. So we're trying to make the message fairly simple, usually a one-page document that has a short paragraph excerpt from the pieces from these major newspapers. So this month's mailing included the Washington Post. That's important for Washington, D.C. But way more important than that, it included the Salt Lake Tribune. It included the newspaper in St. Louis. It included the Kansas City Star. It included the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Those are papers from America's heartland, and it's really important that we show that there is political will out there. So when we send it to the key aides, we send it to the tax aid, we send it to the environmental aid, we send it to the energy aid. So there was a broad distribution, and we'll be sending those out on a regular basis. So that is completely a function of the remarkable work that all of you have been doing. I also want to mention that we thought it was a significant milestone that in the combination of letters, op-eds, editorials, and articles, in November we hit the 100 threshold and thought that would be a high standard to meet in all 4 categories. Well, in the month of January, we had 108 letters to the editor alone. So we'll add in the other categories later when we get to our reports from the field. So, Dr. Trasgueras, I think, you know, you might get an idea from that introduction that the people who you're talking to are people who are in action, are making something happen. You know, oftentimes, I don't know, I've worked in a lot of companies, and I've worked on big problems before. And most people who talk about things in terms of what somebody else ought to be doing. You know, somebody should do something about this. Why isn't this important thing being taken care of? How come nobody? So those are all discussions about not doing something. So you could say that those people are, if you were judgmental, you might say that people are whining and complaining instead of doing something. But we're not judgmental people, so we just say people spend a lot of time talking about not doing something. The people who are actually on the call today are kind of people that when you talk to them, what they tell you is, here's what I did last month, here's what I'm about to do this month. It's the most refreshing group of people I've ever been around, because the issue of global warming and climate change can be daunting, but when you're working around hundreds and hundreds of people who are focused on what they're making happen today, it makes it, from my perspective, much easier to get up and give everything you have to the issue every day. I particularly want to welcome our newest chapters who've had their group start workshops since last month's call. That includes Iowa City, Wisconsin. That includes Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That includes Santa Rosa, California. That includes Bend, Oregon, Medford, Oregon, and Santa Barbara starts today. So we know, Houston, you're on the call. We'll announce you as official group once we actually do the group start workshop. Okay, so our guest speaker today, Dr. Martin Tresguerres, got his master's at the University of Buenos Aires. He got his PhD at the University of Alberta in Canada. I've watched some pretty good videos of Dr. Tresguerres' talk, and I loved how he was lamenting when he was at the University of Alberta that his area of expertise is coral, and he wasn't so sure that he would get a lot of work on that in the middle of Canada. But nevertheless, now he's working at Scripps, and he's an assistant professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he's currently working on a four-year grant from the National Science Foundation to study the effect of ocean acidification. So Dr. Tresguerres, there are a lot of people who are on the call who are scientists, but there's a lot of us who are not. And if you wouldn't mind starting simple and then expand however you want, but I'm familiar with the term ocean acidification. When I hear it, I assume it means something bad. But if you could just start very fundamental, kind of explain what is the nature of ocean acidification, and then anything else you'd like to get into, and then certainly if there's time, we'd like to get questions starting in Coronado, Boston, Sudbury, Ontario, and then Anchorage, Alaska. So Dr. Tresguerres, thank you so much for being on the call this morning.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me here. Yeah, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to explain ocean acidification because it involves many different complicated concepts. So one of them is, for example, what is acidification? And well, acidification happens not only in the ocean, it happens in all fluids or biological fluids, it happens inside cells. It's part of some normal processes that occur due to metabolism, for example. And trying to be very simple, it involves a molecule called a proton, or which is also called acid, and in chemical terms you write that as an H plus, and that plus means that it's a molecule that is charged, and because it's a molecule that is charged, it can change the shape of enzymes and proteins and many different cellular components. And when those components are affected, their function changes and they don't work as well as they should. Now, all organisms, they have the capacity to compensate for those changes in acidity. So it's not like it's something new for animals or organisms to be dealing with changes in acidity. However, the greatest that the stress of acidity, the cells and the organisms, they have to spend more energy to cope with that. And in some cases, if the stress is too hard, they might not be able to do it. Now, when we move that into the ocean, the main... when we move that into the ocean, the thing with ocean acidification is that we have to start with the burning of fossil fuels. And burning of fossil fuel generates a gas that is called carbon dioxide, and there is no question that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been increasing since the Industrial Revolution due to burning of fossil fuels by human activities. And I say that there is no doubt about that because there's a program that was actually started here at Scripps, which they measure carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since the 1950s, and the climb in year after year is, there's no doubt about that. And then we can also look at other things like proxies due in ice cores in the Antarctic and so on. But from 1950 and on, we've actually been measuring this change in CO2 in the atmosphere. Now, in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide generates what's called a greenhouse effect, which we can be talking days about this, but basically leading to climate change and global warming. And we've known about that for a while now. But something that is more recent is that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere eventually dissolves into the ocean, or at least a large part of it dissolves into the ocean. Now, carbon dioxide, when it's in the atmosphere, it remains as a gas. But when carbon dioxide dissolves into water, it combines with water, and it generates this acid, so this proton molecule, the H+ that I was talking before. And as a result, the acidity of the ocean has been increasing constantly, and we expect it to keep increasing for the foreseeable future. Now, the big problem with ocean acidification is not only that the acidity of the ocean is increasing, but also that it is increasing at a very, very, very rapid rate. pH in the oceans has been variable throughout the history of Earth. Sometimes it was much lower than what we have now. Sometimes it was higher. But according to many studies, it seems that the rate at which this acidity or this acidification is happening right now, it's unprecedented in the history of Earth. And that is a very important concept, because animals or organisms, they have the ability to adapt, and if you give it certain time, there might be biological mechanisms that let them adjust to these new conditions. But if you do a change that is very, very rapid, that ability is greatly impaired. I mean, we don't know exactly how organisms are going to respond, and from many, many years of research now, it's very obvious that some organisms are going to do much worse than others. Now, the original concern with ocean acidification is that in addition to changing the pH of the ocean, or as a consequence of changing pH of the ocean, the chemistry of the ocean changes, and in particular, there are these things called calcium carbonate, which are the building blocks of organisms that create shells, such as corals, oysters, mollusks, many different phytoplanktonic or zooplanktonic organisms. And if you reduce the availability of calcium carbonate in the ocean, it's not clear how these organisms will be able to create their own shell. That's still the case. There are many, many, many places that are studying the potential effects on calcifying organisms. But now in the last 2 or 3 years, we're finding that other organisms that do not calcify, they may also be in trouble. And in many cases, we know the consequences, but we don't know the mechanisms. And that's basically the main part of my research project, trying to investigate not only what happens afterwards, but also how it happens and why. I don't know if that. I hope that was clear.
Yes. Let me ask you one thing about that. One of the things you talked about, pH levels in changes in the ocean, is that the changes are non-linear. Can you say what you mean by that, and then what the potential consequences of that are?
Okay, that's a great question. So the changes in what I meant was not necessarily that the changes in pH are not linear, but that the pH scale is not linear. And just a little bit of background on that. The way we measure acidity is through the pH scale, and the pH scale involves there are some complicated equations, so it's basically the negative logarithm of the concentration of the proton ion, of the hydrogen ion, it has a couple of different implications. Number one is that the pH scale, because of that negative value, the pH scale is inversely related to acidity. So the lower the pH, the higher the acidity, and vice versa. So in some cases, you will say increase acidity, but you can also say decrease pH. So sometimes that can be a little confusing, but that's how it is. Now, the other thing is, because there's a logarithm there in the equation, it means that a change of, let's say, one pH unit from 8 to 7 is not a change in one unit. It's a change on a tenfold change in the concentration of hydrogen ions. Now, we can also go to some other give some other examples. For example, a pH of 8.1, which is roughly the average pH on the ocean right now. It's associated with 8 nanomoles of hydrogen ions. But then if you go to a pH of 7.8, so from 8.1 to 7.8, it's a change on 0.3 pH units, but in reality it's a doubling in the amount of hydrogen ions. It goes from 8 to around 16 nanomoles of hydrogen ions. So sometimes it's confusing because many people say, well, it's a change in pH of 0.1 pH units. How bad can it be? And the thing is that it can be something like 30% more hydrogen ions. Imagine if we did a parallel example with temperature and we said that temperature increases 30%. That would be a pretty significant change. And so changes in pH in 0.1, 0.2 pH units can actually be huge.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot more sense now. Yeah, and then your specific area of expertise, the thing that you're studying most is coral, right?
That's an interesting story. I started studying how organisms sense and control pH independently of this thing of ocean acidification. And I've done experiments with sharks and rainbow trout, several crustaceans. And I was always interested in corals, but I only started studying corals about maybe three years ago. My main project is on corals.
And what is it that makes them so complicated to study? I mean, I've read some of the things you've said about it. I've watched you talk on video, but it seems like it's an extremely complicated organism to actually be able to understand.
Yeah, that's correct. When we think about a coral reef, most people imagine these rocks with wonderful corals that are there in some tropical place, almost like a tropical paradise with fish around and everything. But what not many people know is that the actual coral, so the rock, is an animal that it's a very thin layer of cells, about 4 cells in thickness, and it is sitting on top of the rock, and they secrete the rock. So that big chunk of rock that you see actually has a very, very thin layer of about maybe a couple of, the width of a couple of human hairs, which are secreting the skeleton underneath them. Now, to make it more complicated, some of those cells, they host symbiotic algae, which are called zooxanthellae or cymbodinium, and the zooxanthellae are inside cells of the coral host, which are an animal that resembles a sea anemone, to give you an idea. And they help corals live in these tropical waters, which are, in general, very low in nutrients. So it's almost like a farming type of thing. That the animal part of the coral gives shelter to the zooxanthellae. The zooxanthellae, or these algae, that photosynthesis to produce energy, and they shuttle organic compounds to the host, and the host gives some other trade-off to the algae. So just to start with, when we work with corals, we're working with two organisms that live together. That already complicates things. Then it gets more complicated because different, even the same species of coral, they can host different species of algae. And so the physiology of this system it varies from individual to individual. And then from the type of experiments I do, one of the major limitations is that even though we know quite a lot about morphology and diversity and the temperatures that they like or they don't like or that they don't like, what we don't know much is about their basic cell biology. So what I'm trying to do in my lab is to determine some of those basic parameters, and to do that we have to dissociate all the coral, the cells. We work with isolated cells. We have methods that we have developed to separate the cells, keep them in culture, and then study their basic aspects of, for example, pH regulation.
And with respect to coral, I also heard you say that the coral reef in Bermuda is really the canary in the coal mine. And why is that particular coral reef so important to study?
So the reef in Bermuda this came to a surprise to me. I did a field course in Bermuda in the year 2000, and at the moment I was living in Argentina, and when I thought about Bermuda, I didn't really think too much. I thought it was in the Caribbean, you know, next to Jamaica or Cuba. But then if you go into the map and you look at it in the map, it's quite far north. It's a few hours east of North Carolina, basically. And it's however, because of the current of the Gulf of Mexico, the water there is relatively warm, and corals can live there despite being at such a high latitude. Now, it's been, the corals there in Bermuda have been referred as the canary in the coal mine, because we expect that ocean acidification in that area will happen faster, or it's happening at a faster pace compared to, not at a faster pace, but it's happening now. What we see there now is what we might see in other places near the tropics in maybe 20 years. So in a way, it's a time machine to go forward and see how some of these reefs are going to respond. And here at Scripps, we have one professor called Andreas Anderson, who's actually one of the pioneers in ocean acidification and coral reefs. He's a chemist, and he has developed a program called Beacon, in which he's been monitoring pH conditions in the water and how the reefs do for maybe five years now.
Okay, cool. All right, well, one of the things I always tell people is I'm not going to hog all the questions, so let me get some questions from the field. I have other things that I want to ask, but I'm not going to be that greedy. So one question that was submitted in advance was something that I didn't even think to ask, but the Coronado Group asked how acidification affects the Gulf Stream. That would even surprise me as a question, but is there something that you have to say about that?
So can you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, how has ocean acidification affected the Gulf Stream?
The Gulf Stream?
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Well, then we'll start in Boston. And Susan, could you unmute Gary's group's line, and we'll see what they'd like to ask today. Sometimes it takes just a second, Dr. Tony.
Yes.
Hi, can you hear us?
Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear us?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Hi. Thank you for joining us today, Doctor. My question is, I know that on land there are opportunities to naturally sequester carbon, for example, in trees and grasslands, and I'm wondering whether there are parallel mechanisms in the ocean that would either neutralize this excess acidity or become carbon sinks if our oceans were healthier.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question, and for years people have been trying to look at that, and some of the ideas that I'm aware that have been discussed are, for example, fertilizing certain parts of the ocean to make phytoplankton grow faster, which phytoplankton they sequester or they absorb carbon dioxide through photosynthesis. Other options have involved these complicated mechanisms to pump carbon dioxide down into the bottom of the ocean and have it there. But the main problems that I see with those type of approaches is that you don't know what other side effects you might have there if you manipulate the systems at such a large scale. So to my knowledge right now, even though there's lots of talks about these potential strategies, there's nothing really, really solid or nothing that will happen in the near future. And the main thing is, again, that the side effects, sometimes the side effects might be worse than the actual problem.
Great. Okay, good. Well, then, Susan, can you mute Boston and open up Sudbury? Kathy, just have somebody keep saying something out loud till we hear you, okay?
Hi, it's Sudbury.
Go ahead.
Thanks for this great call today. I have a question. I watch a lot of movies and do a lot of public education, and I'm just wondering what I can answer to people when they ask me this question. given the current amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and the rate at which CO2 is increasing, is ocean acidification now a runaway train, or can we, if we mitigate fast enough, will we be able to avoid a collapse of the oceans?
Well, the answer is, I don't know, come see, it's scary but hopeful at the same time. Let's assume that we stop burning fossil fuels right now. Still, the carbon dioxide that is already in the atmosphere will continue dissolving in the ocean, and the ocean will keep acidifying for several decades, if not hundreds of years. And then from there, it will take even a longer time to come back to normal, maybe thousands of years. So in that aspect, it's not like we can do something now and stop it. But what we can do is, and I think it's something urgent that we have to find a way of doing, is to reduce the rate of carbon dioxide consumption generation. And in that way, the rate of change, maybe we can slow it down, or maybe the peak of CO2, an acidification that we will reach, it might be reduced, and that can potentially mitigate many of the worst effects of ocean acidification.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Kathy. Susan, can you mute Sudbury and open up Alaska? And Jim, if you just keep saying something out loud until we can hear you.
Hi, it's Alaska. We have a question, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about ocean acidification and how it varies with depth and with latitude.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're up here in the north, and fishing is the biggest employer in Alaska, and the health of the ocean is very important to our economy up here.
Yeah, I can imagine. So the ocean acidification, even though we talk about average pH on the ocean and that the average pH of the ocean is going down, or so acidity is increasing, it changes a lot due to not only to latitude, but also due to currents. There are some upwellings and downwellings of water and so on. And some of the areas that are predicted to be more affected by this are actually involving in cold regions, which is because carbon dioxide has a higher solubility at colder temperatures. So there's more carbon dioxide dissolving and more generation of acid. Now, with the issue of depth, when we talk about ocean acidification, in general, we refer to the surface of the ocean, so the first maybe foot or so. That, of course, changes due to mixing and so on, but the main problem is the area of the ocean that the pH is changing more at a faster rate is the surface of the ocean.
Okay, and great. Thank you so much for that. Okay, so let me ask you a couple of other things, Dr. Fresquera. So you had talked that there are now multiple stressors on organisms in the ocean. The pH is the one you've mostly been talking about this morning, but then also changes in temperature and then just straight out pollution. So what impact does that have on the organisms? What does that concern you about the organizations who are being stressed on all those three levels?
And that is, for me, that's the most important issue, which is, we call it multi-stressors. In the lab, when we do experiments, we want to see the effects of, for example, ocean acidification or the effect of temperature or pollutants or those type of things. And normally, even though we see an effect, animals are pretty resilient. They're like wonderful machines, if you want to see it that way, and they can adjust to many, many different things. Now, however, even the most resilient organisms, they have troubles when you put several sources of stress. That's easy to see. It happens to us in like every day's life, right? So it is possible that you have, for example, a coral that you reduce the pH or you make the water more acidic, and somehow they compensate for that. The way they compensate for that is by spending more energy to control their own pH, and maybe they can do fine for a while. But then you add another source of stress, like increasing temperature, And now they have to spend more energy also to temperature, and they were already spending more energy into controlling pH. Then maybe you add a pollutant, some toxic things that disrupt some other metabolic process, and now we're really, really in trouble. But like anything in life, when you put a lot of energy into something, you take it from something else. That energy is not infinite, it's limited. So it's easy to see how if you put, let's say, a coral or a fish or any animal puts more energy into adjusting or fighting these changes in pH, then there might have less energy for reproduction or for dispersal or for these other things that are important for survival. So the thing of multi-stressors is a key aspect. And also another thing I always like to see, to mention, is that right now we're focusing on things that we can think about and things that are obvious, like pH, temperature, chemicals in the ocean, and those type of things. But remember that there are probably millions of other things that we don't know about. Contamination or carbon dioxide generation, acidification might be affecting many other things that we cannot measure, but all those things can also be affecting at the same time the organisms.
Okay, good. Well, then let me just ask you one last question then. I know that you've talked about the difficulty of being able to study coral because they're such complicated creatures, but it does seem like you've been able to actually observe the impact on the cells of oysters from changes in pH. Can you tell us what you were able to observe there?
You're probably talking about that my presentation from a few months ago.
Yeah.
In the cells with oysters, actually, what we've done is we developed these techniques for measuring intracellular pH, so the pH inside of cells. And we hope to use those techniques for coral cells as well. But we still, in oysters in particular, we haven't, or corals, we haven't looked at the effects of, we haven't found anything about the effects of OA or intracellular pH yet. And this is because I started working on this maybe 4 months ago. There are, however, many other groups around the world. We collaborate with a group in Monaco who is the expert group in coral physiology. Traditionally, they've been working with corals since Jacques Cousteau in the 1940s and 50s. And they are finding that the acidifying the ocean actually can have an effect on the pH inside of the coral cells. And that might be an explanation of why corals might not be able to calcify as well. Some of the things that I've done in my lab are related to fish. And fish are birds. We still cannot believe some of the results we get. Because traditionally fish were thought to be very resilient to CO2, because you can put them with 10 times the level or even 50 times the level of CO2 that we see now, and the adult fish don't die. But what some groups in Australia and our own research shows is that the behavior of fish can change. They become more anxious, believe it or not. We can measure anxiety in fish. And that can have consequences, potential consequences for how fish move, how they behave, how they recruit, if they reproduce or not. And other research here at Scripps has shown that the otoliths of the fish, which are these little stones, which are they're in the ear of the fish, they help them move and retain equilibrium. It also is affected by ocean acidification. So I guess the answer to your question, I went tangential for your question, but yeah, we still don't know how ocean acidification affects corals. My own research, we're developing the tools to study that, but we do know how it does in some other animals.
Great.
And sometimes you can never really predict what will happen. This thing on affecting fish behavior was totally, totally unexpected.
Yeah. Great. Well, first of all, again, let me thank you so much, A, for the research you're doing, the work that you're doing. We're so grateful to have Scripps as a partner. You know, Dr. Somerville's been on the call before. You know, maybe our most important group is made up of PhD candidates over there, and we have wanted to get into the issue of the ocean and ocean acidification for some time. So we're really, really grateful that you issues available today. We're grateful for all your work you're doing, and thank you so much for being on with us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. Let me mention also that one of our favorite organizations in D.C., Ocean Conservancy, is working very intently on ocean issues, and if this is an area that people on the call are passionate about, that is a very good organization to follow. CCL are big fans of them, and they're doing really phenomenal work also, so we're glad that we can have a partnership with Ocean Conservancy and Scripps. We feel like that gives us an enormous amount of access to what's happening on our oceans and what we can do about it. Okay, so I think one of the things that people are aware of is that we have been working intently to try and find people to work across the aisle. And we're always looking for opportunities where we can get Republicans and Democrats to collaborate, and particularly in key committees. I mentioned on the start of today's call that we're very much focused on the Senate Finance Committee, but also the House Ways and Means. And we've looked for, and we've had some times where we're more successful than other times successful at getting Republicans and Democrats talking to each other. And one of our, again, we're really lucky is that because we have a group in Washington, D.C., we can have collaborative work where we'll have someone who's developing a relationship with an office, you know, maybe in Utah or Nevada, but we can, when we need to have a visit there and it's not during the national conference, someone from the D.C. group can go actually make the visit. So last week, Leslie Downey had some really good visits with people on Ways and Means from both the Republican and Democrat side, did really good work, worked on trying to get them to be together, and both the aide on the Republican and the Democratic side were really complaining to Leslie that the reason it was hard to work with other because it was the other people's fault. They started it, they're mean. So, you know, we are always working to get people to work across the aisle, but part of that is us developing relationships, and by that I mean deep and powerful relationships with members in their Congress and their staff so that we can actually get them to work together. So when Leslie wrote a really fantastic debrief notes, Ellie Sparks wrote, I thought, just a really, really great commentary on what our role is in dealing with these kinds of aides who are trying to work their issues out. And I asked Ellie if she would read those comments to the rest of us that she sent back to Leslie. So, Susan, can you unmute Ellie?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Awesome. All right, so here's my email. Leslie, at CCL, we are both matchmaker and therapist. I'm going to share a personal story with you to illustrate my thoughts on this. The hardest thing I have had to do in my marriage was to draw a line in the sand for my safety and then surrender to healing. My husband struggled with anger management. He came from a family where yelling and beating were the way adults handled any situation. This was not the case in my house of origin. I found myself 15 years into a marriage and with two children when I was finally able to put words to my experience. I loved my husband, but I did not feel safe in my house. So I said that to him. I want you to know that I love you, and I need to feel safe in my house. That hit him like a ton of bricks. His own wife did not feel safe in her house, and neither did his children, all because of his inability to manage his anger. So he went to get help with anger management. He went to get help regardless of whether our marriage would survive. He went to get help for himself. And I gave it time and decided to live in the present moment. That meant I would tell him when he did or said something that made me feel unsafe. That meant I would not hold against him every time or even any time he had lost his cool in the past. That was hard work on both our parts. He has been going to anger management counseling for 18 months. It is just now that I can trust the clock to tick and him not to explode unexpectedly. And we are just now beginning to unravel and deal with the damage his anger mismanagement caused our 14-year-old daughter. That is a painful journey for all of us, but the work has begun. The tools we use to repair our family, our marriage counseling, anger management counseling, individual counseling, and family counseling. The highlighted part of your email reminds me of the mindset that my husband and I can get into that keeps us stuck in the past and unable to be fully present in the current moment. Each of us blames the other for the mess we find our family in. The very hard part is to let go of our memories of our past failures. I want to blame him for all of our problems. He wants to blame me for all of our problems. When the truth is, I made mistakes, he made mistakes, we are living consciously now. We get to make a decision about today's problems with two people who are fully present. We retreat to the bedroom and talk through our ideas in private instead of yelling in front of the kids. We get the resources we need in place to succeed. Then we let our kids know what our plan is. We take it one step at a time. Our family is worth it. Our kids are worth it. We are worth it. Our challenge, and it is the big one, is how do we help our members of Congress let go of past hurt and be fully present in the moment so that they can solve the climate crisis? So you, my friend, are not only matchmaker, but also marriage counselor, anger management therapist, individual counselor, and family counselor to Congress in general and to these two gentlemen in particular. It is hard to imagine how two groups who have been at each other's throats for decades can let down their guard and solve the climate crisis. But that's what's going to have to happen. So will these two members of Congress and their staff be the ones to do it? To step up to the plate and provide the bipartisan support that a climate change solutions bill requires to succeed? I certainly would like to see that happen for the sake of these two members of Congress, for their districts, and for the world. Please also know that you are not alone. There are other CCL volunteers being matchmakers and marriage counselors. All of this work, like marriage counseling, is being done with a sense of intimacy and tenderness. One of these congressional marriages will be the one to carry us forward. You, my darling, as a CCL volunteer, are also Pathfinder. You are finding the pathway that our tribe can take to get out of danger and find safety and security again, our global tribe. So we are, all of us together, the Pathfinders. Much love, and keep reaching for the next step, Ellie.
Great. Ellie, thank you so much for sharing that. And, you know, I think it's always easy to just take the simple answer and say, you know, it's too intractable, it's too hard. And I have shared this with a lot of people about every time I work with Ellie is every day she gets up and she's out to find what the answer is today. Not a little piece of it, not, you know, what's my bit I can do, but what's something that is the broadest possible answer to the whole problem. So thank you again, Ellie, for giving us a context to do our work. And it's just amazing to have you as part of Citizens Climate Lobby.
Thanks.
Okay, yeah, great. So let's get into a few of the other things that happened since last month's call, because there are a lot of people that were busy out there. And let me say also, before we get into that, I know that a lot of people on the call are going to Washington, D.C. on February 17th, and we're really excited about that. And your group leader has contact information for Siren Ehrenstar, our co-leader in Washington, D.C., who's going to be organizing all the people from Citizens Climate Lobby who are coming to D.C. And she has a bunch of Citizens Climate Lobby hats. So if you're going to be there on the 17th, make sure you find where those people are so you can see Siren and see the other Citizens Climate Lobby who will be there supporting the hopefully 40 or 50,000 people. I'm pretty confident that there'll be that many people there doing everything we can to make sure the tar sands are not built. Okay, Amy, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mark. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. So I said at the first of the call that the most pieces we had ever published in the history of the organization, if we add up letters to the editor, editorials, op-eds, and articles, was 100 in November, and we had 108 letters alone in January. We had 9 editorials. We had a total of 22 editorials last month, 9 this month, 16 op-eds, and 9 articles, which means we had a total of 142 pieces published. I think that a lot of people out there, I'm not the only one who's on too many listservs of getting a lot of articles that are published out there, and I think a lot of you have probably read the commentary or maybe the piece written by Theda Skocpol. I don't know how to pronounce her name. She's the political scientist from Harvard, but she talked about the failure of previous attempts to pass climate legislation being a lot because they were beltway-driven, not grassroots support, and this is just a remarkable achievement by all of you this month again. So, Amy, I know that you would want to mention every group because there's so much stuff that happened, but what are some of the highlights you saw this month?
Oh, Mark, it was an amazing month, and you're right. To be fair, we have to mention every group, and there's just never enough time. Kansas City was published 6 times. Madison was published 9 times. And, Mark, do you want to tell us about Canada?
Yeah, Canada set a goal this year of saying if they got 15 letters to the editor a month, that would be a total of 180 letters over the year, which would double what they did last year. And they started with January with 17 letters. Great, Kathy, Cheryl, Christine, everybody up there, that's fantastic work. And particularly, 4 pieces in the Financial Post. I know it's not an exact equivalent of the Wall Street Journal, but it is very much the same kind of entity in Canada as the Wall Street Journal. So really, really great work in Canada this month.
Mark, also, I want to tell you about what Long Island did this month. They went to 6 screenings of Chasing Ice, and they either spoke at those screenings or handed out flyers or both. And each one of those shows had around 45 people attending, so that was terrific. And then Utah held a writing workshop where 7 people attended and wrote LTEs and op-eds.
Yeah, I'm hoping that more groups decide to take up this whole writing workshop thing, because I read an op-ed in the Salt Lake Tribune this morning, and frankly, it knocked my socks off. So that was really, really powerful. Anything else, Amy?
No, that's it for today, Mark.
Okay, great, 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 great. All right, Susan, could you unmute Lene Pentengill? So the Kansas City Star was one of the papers that had the editorials that we mentioned when we said we were able to compile a handful of editorials, so that's the position of the newspaper, send them to key congressional aides, which we will be doing as more pieces get published. Lene wrote an op-ed in response to that editorial where I thought she made some key points. She made a lot of the standard key points that most of us do about the efficiency of putting a fee, why it makes sense to return to citizens, but I thought she made some other key points that I wanted her to share with everybody, so I wanted her to read a couple of paragraphs. Are you there, Lene?
Yeah, can you hear me, Mark?
Yeah, I can. And let me just say one more thing before Lene starts speaking. So the Kansas City Star is a great paper. It serves both Kansas and Missouri. It's the first job that Ernest Hemingway had. So the first place where Ernest Hemingway was published was the Kansas City Star. So I guess you could say it's a significant paper because it was published both Ernest Hemingway and Lene Pentengill.
Good company. All right, so you want me to go ahead and start reading?
Please go ahead.
All right, so why the Republican Party should back a carbon tax. It was a relief to listen to President Barack Obama's inaugural speech and hear him say, "We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms." Then I'm going to skip quite a bit and go to the ending. In an August 12, 2012 article on Bloomberg.com, Ernst & Young awarded China #1 world renewable energy ranking with a score of 70.2, while the U.S. and Germany tied for second place, both with scores of 66. An on-again, off-again wind energy production tax credit policy is partly to blame for our country's position in these rankings. Uncertainty regarding the future of renewables would be eliminated with the passage of a revenue-neutral carbon tax, and we would create millions of new green jobs as we move forward to become the world leader in renewable energy rankings. Any cries you might hear of, "This will kill jobs," is simply untrue. In his book, Building a Green Economy, Joseph Robertson reports the following. Direct job creation for oil and natural gas is 0.8 jobs per 1 million in output, and coal's is 1.9 jobs per million in output. Compare that to building retrofits for energy efficiency, which directly creates 7 jobs per 1 million in output. Mass transit services create 11, and the smart grid creates 4.3. Wind, solar, and biomass power generation create 4.6, 5.4, and 7.4 jobs per 1 million in output, respectively. So back to the Republicans. What's not to love about a revenue-neutral tax on carbon? It does not increase the size of government. It provides a market-based solution to the climate change crisis. It encourages innovation and entrepreneurial efforts, and it creates jobs. America is a can-do nation. We just need a little nudge in the right direction. Then our inventors, investors, and technicians can take it from there. Mr. President, thank you for your commitment to addressing climate change this term. Now I ask the Republican members of Congress to take the lead by passing a revenue-neutral tax on carbon. Our children and future generations are counting on you.
Great. Fantastic piece, Lene. Thank you so much. I'm so happy it got published, and thank you for reading it this morning. Appreciate that so much.
Sure. Thanks, Mark.
Okay, great. All right, Steve Volk, can you give us this month's, the U.S. and Canadian laser talks are pretty close. We're going to read the U.S.-Canadian laser talks and actions. Kathy has distributed the Canadian action sheet to everybody. You'll see the first action is pretty close. The second one's a little bit different, but we'll just do the one. Sometimes we include both. Sometimes we just do the one. So, Steve Volk, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. So we'll go for the laser talk first and then talk about the actions. Okay, great. In his inaugural speech, and now in his State of the Union address, President Obama has indicated that we will respond to the threat of climate change, making it a priority in his second term. Lacking a legislative solution from Congress, the President will turn to regulation to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that are heating up our world. Republicans would prefer to avoid any expansion of government regulations. But they may welcome the alternative of responding to the climate challenge with a revenue-neutral carbon tax that uses the power of the free market to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A steadily rising tax on carbon, with revenue returned to consumers, would motivate the private sector to invest heavily in clean energy and speed the transition away from fossil fuels. A number of conservative economists support the carbon tax, including Reagan advisor Art Laffer and Romney advisor Greg Mankiw. One way or another, America must respond. Republicans, who hate regulations, can answer the call with a free market approach of a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And so the two actions that we have this month, one of them is to ask our senators to join Senator Boxer's Climate Change Clearinghouse. But the main action that we have this month is this big opportunity that we have with letters to the editor responding to President Obama's State of the Union address. And, of course, the President made the statements that he made in his inaugural. It's anticipated he will follow up with that in his State of the Union address. And so newspapers all across the country will be reporting on this. And so what we suggest is at your meetings today, draft the letters that you would send after the President's State of the Union address. And then once the address has been made, you can take what the President said and include that in your letters and submit your letters.
Great. Crystal clear, Steve. Thank you so much. All right, everybody. Again, I think it's a huge, huge opportunity depending upon what the President either says or not says. You know, one of the things we said last month is we will start adding an additional laser talk in getting ready for the conference in June. The one that we added this month is why we prefer a carbon tax over cap and trade. You know, there are three options for dealing with reducing emissions. The one the administration has signaled they're going to use is using EPA authority. Sometimes people refer to that as command and control. So if you hear the term command and control, they're actually talking about EPA authority, which is essentially additional regulation. Then the other options are a carbon tax or cap and trade. Our second laser talk is why we prefer a carbon tax over cap and trade. Okay, then the last thing I want to mention is this. I said at the start of the call that the 2013 conference is now officially open for registration. Now, there is limited space so that if you want to come, you should make sure and get yourself registered for the conference. But I do want to say that the conference is not for everybody. The conference does significant damage to most people's cynical view of government. And it is, let's just be honest with ourselves. It's always a lot easier to sit there and say snarky things to our friends about how it's too hard and it's impossible and it's unfair and there's too much money and blah, 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 and anybody can do that. It's always great when we have chances to go visit our members of Congress, our members of Parliament when they're in the district. But when you are walking the halls of those white marble halls, and you see hundreds of other people who have access to their government, and you're able to share notes with them about, it's a moment that you can't come back from. So for some people, this isn't the right thing to do, because a better thing to do would be to hang on to the view of there's nothing we can do. You'll never get over being at the conference if you come. So if it's the right thing for you, I hope you're there. I hope you make sure and register yourself. As I mentioned, Dr. James Hansen's going to be there, Dr. Shiling Su. His book, A Case for a Carbon Tax, may seem like it is overly aimed towards a carbon tax, but it is simply the most cogent argument on carbon pricing anybody has ever put together. Again, thank you, Dr. Treskaris, and everybody who spoke on the call today. And everybody, thank you so much for all the amazing work you're doing. Goodbye, everybody. Have a great day. We'll talk to you in a month.